Hello and welcome to the first inaugural, I think those are the same word, Yanks Are Coming Soccer Show. I'm Neil Blackman. I'm one of the hosts, I'm the co-founder of theyanksarecoming.com. Also, you can read my writing in a bunch of other places. Follow me on Twitter at NW Blackman. My co-host, Kartik Krishnayar, will be joining me in just a moment. Kartik is a longtime veteran soccer journalist, was the spokesman for the NASL, has worked in a host of different capacities in soccer, hosted several of these shows. So co-hosting, getting Kartik to co-host with me is a big deal because he's smart and he's been around this game a bit. We have a big show today. We're going to talk about a lot of things as 2016 ends. I think one of the more significant ends of the year in terms of news that we've had in a long time. You'd be hard pressed to identify a year in soccer in this country where more has happened in the last 2 months. And that's including years where there's been World Cup draws that coincided with MLS Cup final, things of that nature. So I think, there's a lot to talk about. We're going to start that conversation by introducing Kartik, letting him introduce himself. Most of you know who he is if you're listening to us on the first try. So my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar, hello.
Hi, Neil. Great to be with you. A little bit of a connection issue coming in, so I'm sorry I'm coming in about a minute late. Most of you know me. If you want to get more familiar with me, just follow me at KKFLA737 on Twitter.
Yeah. I was just kind of introducing you, but I wanted to just kind of dive right into stuff because one of the things that we talked about preparing this show was that this has been an extraordinarily eventful last month to a U.S. soccer calendar, and all of this occurring after the victory by the Sounders in MLS Cup, or at least some of it, but certainly since really Veterans Day, quite an eventful time to be a U.S. soccer fan. There's a lot to digest. We're not going to get into everything back to Veterans Day. That's ridiculous. And there's plenty of other podcasts that have done a great job on that. But we are going to talk a little bit about the year that was. But I want to start with the most recent news, the most topical thing right now, which was Bob Bradley's 85-day tenure as the manager at Swansea City.
Yeah, it was I think, Neil, it's something that really kind of hit home in the American soccer community. Would you agree with that, the Bradley departure?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was so much made about, whether or not it was a sort of a seminal moment for American managers abroad, whether it was, Bob has to succeed or no other American manager is going to get an opportunity. Is this the most important tenure in the history of an American manager? And all this sort of external pressure, I don't think it's something that necessarily Bob Bradley felt. But for it to end in 85 days after 11 matches, I think was sort of a shock or a jolt to the system.
Yeah, and I think what you found with a lot of folks that maybe don't follow the Premier League very closely or European football, club football very closely, not realizing how cutthroat the business is and how critical, particularly in the Premier League now with the television money, how critical avoiding relegation is, particularly for new owners who are American owners who are investing for the first time in a European football project. So I think that was the thing, the realization that a lot of folks didn't quite get when he got the appointment. The assumption was when he was appointed, he'd be given time, he'd be given a transfer window. This would be the start of a project. Unfortunately, look, I mean, I fell into the same trap. I was watching every Swansea game religiously. If it was on NBC Sports Extra Time, I was watching that instead of watching whatever game they had on CNBC or NBCSN. It was very much a seminal moment for all of us as American soccer folks when he got that job. But I think the question mark going forward after that was specifically how long would he get? I think the assumptions that he would get the entire season were probably ill-founded given the stakes in a relegation fight. And the reality of the situation is that I don't think Swansea has a very good team. I think they've made multiple mistakes in the transfer windows the last four seasons under Hugh Jenkins, who's their chairman. Or maybe not the last four seasons, but certainly since Michael Laudrup was the manager. So, yeah, maybe the last three seasons. And they've, they're in this position now where they need a quick fix, and they need to somehow survive a relegation battle. So they're going to try and walk it back and go from being a team that has played very good, slick, expansive football, which Bob tried to do, to being a team that sits back and plays for nil-nils and one-nils.
Yeah, so let's dive into that a little bit. The average tenure for a manager in the Premier League is 450 days. Okay? So it's not like everybody gets a couple of years to sort of install their system. And in fact, the Premier League is kind of the antithesis of, say, a Germany, where you actually have a lot of system-based clubs. Those sorts of things don't happen in the Premier League. You kind of touched on that. But should I saw a tweet from Richard Farley, which, you know, who we both respect a great deal. And he kind of, and I don't necessarily agree with the tweet, I just thought it was interesting that he said the reasonable criticisms, there aren't really reasonable criticisms for criticizing Bradley's dismissal. Like the results and the way that they were playing justified him being dismissed. I mean, what's your kind of position on that?
Yeah, I tend to have taken that position that the results justified the sacking. At the same time, I think that there might have been a clear mandate from the board to play football a certain way, or maybe, and we can get into this, because there was so much criticism or fascination or whatever you want to interpret it as about an American manager with an American accent coming into the Premier League, he felt like he had to play football in a very open and slick manner, which led itself to leaking goals in an almost unprecedented manner for a Premier League club. The match they played against Spurs a few weeks ago where they lost 5-0 was one of the single worst performances I've seen a Premier League club give. They were outshot 29-1. They were outshot on target 14-0. So it felt a little bit like U.S. versus Argentina, quite frankly. And I know we're going to talk about that game later in the show. But I think
foreshadowing.
There might have been – but, you know, there might have been – I agree with Richard's premise, although I'm wondering if Bob, as I – take a step back a couple days later and look at this situation. Maybe he felt he had to play that way, which lent itself to an openness that prevented the ability to consolidate and get the kind of results maybe he needed. And if he had been another nationality, maybe he would have played it very differently.
Yeah, I guess, and this is, I'm mostly asking Cardick these questions because this is a league that Cardick has written books about and covered, whether it's in writing and print journalism or on podcasts for more years than I have, for sure. Most of us stateside, but you don't learn a lot about a manager in 11 games. We can both agree about that, I think. So I think
absolutely.
I think that it's less an indictment of him and more reflection on this is just what the league is now. I mean, you just can't get relegated. And so if after 11 games, understand that there were some questions about whether the players had a sense of belief in Bob. And certainly, like you said, you have new ownership. So, you know, to what extent, if anything is unfair, I think the most reasonable criticism, I guess, is that he didn't get a transfer window when you have a squad that's clearly deficient.
Right. And I think that this is something that is new to English football, because in Italy and Spain, clubs have cycled through managers for generations, where they give a manager 5 games, 8 games, 10 games, often outside of transfer windows to fix things. And if things don't turn around, they sack them. In England, historically, managers have been given, if not a full least one transfer window, which is what I think the expectation was for Bradley among both American fans and fans in the UK, quite frankly. But it's now the stakes. It's the stakes of relegation. It's the money that's on the line, the television money. And this is a new thing this season. Well, actually, it started last season because teams didn't want to drop out of the Premier League before the new television contract kicked in. But it's Bradley might be the harbinger of a trend where managers are brought in and they're sacked pretty quickly, making England really no different than Spain or Italy. And stability in management was one thing that English football always kind of held its hat on. And they had these two shining examples in Wenger and Ferguson. But they also had other managers that lasted 4, 5, 6 years at the club, like Tony Pulis did at Stoke, as Alan Pardew did at Newcastle. And they've gotten away from that recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's – this is sort of an – where this discussion gets really fascinating is that, okay, you want Bob Bradley to – let's say you're one of the American fans that's upset. You think that he should have gotten at least a transfer window. So then I think the next step to – if you have to follow that discussion. You can't just assert that, right? It's a claim without a warrant. So what's your warrant for making that assertion? The warrant would usually be so that he can install his tactical system or whatever, that there's a tactical ethos behind a Bob Bradley team, that ethos would have ultimately worked. That's not what the Premier League is it? I mean, I guess more succinct, more shortly, maybe more aptly phrased. How many teams beyond, say, Arsenal in the Premier League are teams that have sort of a guiding tactical imprimatur that they follow, as opposed to, you know, sure, there's sort of blueprints and you tactically treat each game in a certain way, but you're not identifying players and bringing them in because they fit your system necessarily in England as you are in, say, Germany.
Right. Yeah. I think
is that fair?
Definitely. Yeah, that's very fair. I think Germany is definitely a much better example of that. There are some exceptions in England. Arsenal, you mentioned, obviously it's a shining one. West Ham has always had a style to how they play. And that's why Sam Allardyce, even though he kept them in the league, was really so I got them promoted back to the Premier League and kept them in the league, was so unpopular among their supporters, and why, even though Village, I think, for most of this season had them at a lower position in the table than Allardyce did those previous years when he had managed the club in the Premier League, the fans had not turned on Village. Also, Village is a former West Ham player, popular West Ham player, so that fits into that. But one of the clubs that did have some sort of guiding principle in how they played was Swansea, starting with Roberto Martinez, going through Paulo Sousa and Brendan Rodgers, and continuing up through Gwendolyn had made them a little more defensive. But there had always been this passing principle and this movement with Swansea, embodied by Leon Britton and Joe Allen and kind of slick, smallish midfield players that were able to move the ball around and keep possession. That's very much what Bob Bradley tried to do. He tried to play football out of the back. He tried to play with the ball on the ground. And that's why I think there has to be some sympathy expressed for him here, because I get the sense that might very well have been a mandate from the board or an assumption on how he was supposed to proceed as Swansea manager based on the ethos of the club. And based on the fact that he was an American and maybe would be insecure if he just set up shop or shut up shop like Pulis and Allardyce are known to do. Pulis even more radically than Allardyce. Allardyce is a defensive manager, but he certainly got more progressive elements than Tony Pulis does. So I think maybe he needed to be more of a Tony Pulis or a Sam Allardyce, and if all things were being equal, he might have done that, but instead he was forced to proceed in this fashion. So that's why there is some sympathy for him, though I think based on the results and based on the score lines and how ugly it looked in the process, Richard's tweet is on the money. But I think that there might have been some external factors driving Bradley to play the way they did at Swansea.
One thing that I thought, and I told, I think, you know, I kind of devil's advocated Richard on this a little bit, but I would say, and you and I have discussed it in kind of the run-up to the show, the mandate to the board question is an interesting one for me. If Bob had a mandate from the board, that's fascinating. If he had, he also might have an alternative theory, I guess, or I suppose you could combine them, would be that Bob looked at the personnel that he had and just determined that he didn't really have a coverage midfielder to hold with. His center backs weren't good enough in the air to win if he decided to quote unquote bunker. And so they had to attack. And also you chase games when you concede the first goal. So when your center backs are leaky and you don't have a holding midfielder, all these things pile up on one another. But if you look at Swansea's roster, it was difficult to bunker because they don't really have a ball-winning aerial center back. They don't have a coverage midfielder. They don't really have a guy like, say, Michael Bradley that can deliver a ball from deep in the scrum, right? So you have to bypass the midfield. They might be able to do that, but you still have to defend. You still have to be able to clear the ball. They're not really set up to do that either. And then you get behind. How many of these players, if you had to rebuild Swansea now, how many would you keep? I mean, I can't see more than four.
Yeah, not many. Look, I think Ashley Williams departing in the summer was a devastating blow to the club, the heart and soul of the club. They didn't replace him adequately, not even moderately adequately. I mean, they're going with center backs that are just not of that standard. And then the failure to re-sign Joe Allen when Liverpool sold him to Stoke, and it looked like he had an agreement with Swansea, and that fell through. That really limited what they could do because Allen's that guy that can deliver the ball like Michael Bradley, maybe even at a higher level. I think Bob Bradley would have salivated over having a Joe Allen-type player, a player also who can make late runs into the box and score goals or even score from distance. Very similar, actually, to Michael Bradley. And I think folks saw that at the Euros this summer with Wales and how successful Joe Allen was. Yeah, guys on this team that I would keep, obviously Sigurdsson is an out-of-sight player, great player, Icelandic international who was with Swansea before during their rise and then left and went to Spurs for a year or two. He's a top player. Beyond that, look, I mean, maybe you keep Leon Britton because of his experience and his ability to move the ball side to side. Maybe a Jack Cork or Leroy Fair, although Leroy Fair is a player who's just never reached the potential that many felt he had. On the back line, I don't keep anyone. Fabianski, the goalkeeper, is pretty good. Yeah, there are like three or four guys, maybe Jefferson Montero, maybe Wayne Routledge. That's it.
Right. And I think that you'll note that none of those guys are people that play defense. So,
correct.
Just defensively, the personnel is so bad that I think you have to ask questions about what necessarily tactically you can do. That said, you know, we kind of write off, oh, well, they attack because they're chasing the game because they conceded the first goal. That's on Bob, and he'd be the first one to tell you that. I mean, at some point, you have to at least draw up a plan where you're not conceding a goal in 10 minutes because that's not always going to be the players. There are ways to try to prevent that from occurring. And like you said, they had great tactical moments under Bradley, particularly against Arsenal. They were very good. But then there was the Spurs match where they were just overwhelmed. And, you know, you have to make adjustments, which I think is not something that necessarily happened. So it's a tough break to lose your job in 85 days. But I don't think it's necessarily as much of an indictment on Bob Bradley's abilities as a manager as some people, particularly in the foreign press, have made it out to be. Would you, you know, is that fair to say before we move on?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that, and I think he could secure another job in the near future. I've seen buzz about the Norwegian national team job, which is kind of a thankless job. They've underachieved internationally for many years, but it might be the kind of project Bradley would embrace and do very well with. And there is a core of kind of middle-aged players who could help them through World Cup qualifying. They won't qualify, but it might be the kind of job he embraces. So there is still some buzz about him taking another job. I think the thing Bradley beat up his team about and beat himself up about wasn't conceding that first goal. And I agree with you, he could have set up his teams tactically to where he didn't give up the first goal. We saw it a lot of times as U.S. men's national team manager where I think of the Ghana game, I think in the World Cup in 2010, I think of the El Salvador game in qualifying in 2009, the Honduras game in 2009 in qualifying in Chicago, and then also the game against England in the World Cup in 2010, where Bradley Smith gave up quick goals. And there was something wrong tactically, and he fixed it. He fixed it in the Ghana game before the 45th minute, right? He made a change. He brought on Benny Feilhaber for Rico Clark in that game. But what Bradley talked about publicly before he was sacked was, we have to realize we were down a goal. We don't go chase that goal back. We sit, we play with the ball a little bit, we keep possession, and then we attack. His team never quite figured that out. They would chase that equalizer and get caught out rather quickly, and then it was all downhill from there. So that was something that he beat himself up about. It was giving up that second goal, except 1-0 games are manageable. And we see so many games in England, particularly when you have a player like Sigurdsson standing over set pieces. He's one of the best ball strikers in the league. That's one thing Swansea does have going for them. When you have a player like that, you can get a set piece in minute 80 or 85 and equalize, or minute 90 into stoppage time. We've seen Tony Pulis teams do that for years, where they get completely outplayed in a game, be down 1-0, and then they score on a set piece. And Swansea had the right guy to do that in Sigurdsson, but when you're down 2-0 and 3-0, it just doesn't happen.
Now, Bob doesn't have to carry the banner for American managers either. Obviously, there is an American manager that's had success right now in the lower divisions of England. There is an American that's a technical director at a successful club in Holland. That was, at least until returning home. It can be done. So it's kind of hard to say, well, I hope that Bob does this. I mean, I think at this point, Bob Bradley doesn't really have anything to prove unless he feels like he does. And then, you know, if he wants to stay, that's great. Certainly LAFC, he'll be at the top of that discussion, I would imagine. Do you have a hope as to what he does next? Because honestly, it's hard for me, like journalist hat on, it's difficult for me to say, well, I hope he does this. I mean, it'd be great if he stayed. I think he's proven that he can manage a team that's fighting for promotion. You know, he's done that. What he did in France was a near miracle. So I think maybe that sort of position would be good for him.
I'd love for him to get another chance in England with a club like that, that's chasing promotion. That's really what I'd like to see, but I don't know. Maybe his brand is damaged in England, but nowhere else. I think he can easily go back into the French second division to a club like Le Havre or go back to a club in Norway, in Scandinavia and manage and make a nice career of it. So I'd rather see him do that than go to LAFC, quite frankly.
Yeah, that's fair. Let's just stay with, we'll close with the women because it's just easier to transition to the men's national team from Bob Bradley. Year in review wise, it's hard to call for a narrative answer in terms of what your conception of this year was, but the article that the piece that I'm putting out for Yanks are coming anytime in the next 12 hours, whenever it gets edited, will essentially argue this was a really weird year for the men's program. That we saw some tremendous successes, but also some of the worst soccer that we've seen in quite some time. What's kind of a final, is there a lasting image to you of the year that was for 2016 with the men's national team?
Yeah, probably Brad Guzan making a number of saves against Costa Rica in the first half in a game that was already out of hand at 0-0. And that just reinforced to me how Jurgen Klinsmann had lost the dressing room, how tactically he couldn't set up the team to even compete away from home in a tough environment, and that he was the wrong man for the job. So even before the four goals came in for Costa Rica, I'm remembering my image as Guzan just being under assault 10 to 15 minutes into the match, making some dramatic saves to temporarily keep the U.S. in the game. That, unfortunately, is my lasting image.
I like that one because it beckons to the 2015 image of Brad Guzan under assault in a third place match against Panama, which was
a game where we were outshot something like 10-1.
A game where Brad Guzan made more saves than Tim Howard made against Belgium. Okay.
So, right, so then it's more than 10.
And that, yeah, that was then, what, 3 months before I wrote a piece that was at least somewhat well-received after the CONCACAF Cup, that it was time for the United States to move on from Jurgen Klinsmann, and that you could appoint sort of instead of a stopgap manager, and we'll get to that, you could appoint, you know, kind of a regime change manager. If you want to appoint an Oscar Pereja to manage the U.S. men's national team, you do it before you begin the qualifying adventure. You don't do it when you're 0-2 in the hex. Or at least that's conventional wisdom. And maybe you throw all that out the window, but the U.S. obviously has chosen not to. So to me, it's telling that your image of 2016 is Brad Guzan kind of swinging at windmills a la Don Quixote down in Costa Rica, which, you know, there's no shame in losing to Costa Rica. It's what the U.S. do. It's the way that they were humiliated, I think, that is kind of – the last game is the last impression. Let's talk about the Copa America, because it was kind of the high point of 2016. The big observation for me is that Clint Dempsey still scored the goals. You know, Jozy Altidor just was named the men's player of the year. I registered my dissent to that in print form and in social media form, not because I thought Jozy didn't have the best year of his career. He did. Who's going to score the goals? If Clint can't return, the U.S. now scored one goal in their first 180 minutes of the hex without Clint Dempsey. Where do they come from?
The U.S. has long been reliant on goals from players playing in that kind of role. Dempsey, Donovan, before that, the likes of Ernie Stewart and Joe Max Moore. So it's going to have to come from someone playing that role. Maybe it's a Christian Pulisic playing in that kind of hybrid attacker midfield role or attacking midfield role. Is it going to be someone like Julian Green or Alejandro Bedoya? All I know is that the U.S. historically has not been able to stay above water without that particular player playing that role, scoring bunches of goals in international competition.
Yeah. The Americans shift back to the 4-4-2 in the humbling defeat to Costa Rica. They had had good success with that at the Copa America and then abandoned it against Mexico in what was maybe in a series of shocking tactical developments. Well, I'm skipping the Colombia match for the third place. So let's say the U.S. had three pretty critical competitive matches, Argentina in the semifinal of the Copa America, and then the Mexico match in Columbus. Obviously, they had the Trinidad match where they played very well in Pulisic's first start in between those, as well as another qualifier. But Klinsmann tactically was at base just a pragmatist. Which makes these sort of arguments about a return to arena kind of odd to me, because it's not like Klinsmann ever actually imposed a style or an attacking style that he promised in his opening press conference. What was your thought beyond, oh, this is a stopgap and a guy who understands the hex? How have you seen Bruce Arena grow since the defeat to Ghana in 2006?
I think he's a more attack-minded manager. He's willing to incorporate more kind of creative players that take more touches on the ball than potentially he did before. No, for me, like a key difference between him and Bob Bradley, if you look at MLS, the ability of Bob Bradley at two different clubs to incorporate Amaro Gamara into being the centerpiece of how he built his teams at the Metro Stars, and then Chivas, which was awarded because he got the U.S. job. Bruce Arena never really liked that kind of player when he was with DC United or with the national team. But now I think he's grown because he's had to incorporate the likes of Janino and Gio DeSantos and Robbie Keane, who he drips a little deep for a striker. And he's had to play with a different tactical look than he perhaps had for DC United or the U.S. the first round. That having been said, Bruce is a little underrated tactically in his ability to see some trends before games to set up the team properly. Now, does he make the changes on the fly that Bob Bradley does? No. He doesn't read a game as once the game starts as well as Bradley does. Now, as far as Klinsmann, he's worse than Bradley or Arena in all these categories. As far as I'm concerned, so he's not even worthy of discussion.
Well, and this is another kind of telling moment of 2016 was that the U.S. played maybe its most fluid, consistent, best game of the Klinsmann era in the quarterfinals of the Copa America against Ecuador. And it was 90 quality minutes. And they follow it up with the only real tactical ethic that they brought to the Argentina match was having Chris Wondolowski, who had never done this, track Javier Mascherano and just chase him around the park. And Wando is a good professional, so he tried to do it. And it was just a colossal failure. And so the U.S. was crushed. The U.S. was crushed for a lot of reasons, but that was certainly something that I think was a big part of it. The work of Bruce Arena to kind of make this point is that Bradley's ability to adjust to specific types of games, to specific in-game situations, I'm not sure that's necessarily a strength that Bruce Arena shares with them for all the similarities that they have. So I think what Bruce has to figure out is what sort of personnel sets does he have that, and then this is going to start in the January camp, and this is the danger of using him as a stopgap, is what personnel sets can he rely on to kind of make sure that the U.S. is very unfailingly consistent on the defensive side? And then, like you said, you just kind of keep using that position to find the goals.
For me, Arena is probably going to some of the players that are in the pool that haven't gotten necessarily the love thus far. I mean, a guy like Kellen Acosta, I think, very well into what he's historically done. Lyndon Gooch, if he gets fit at Sunderland, is a player that I think fits the kind of Eddie Lewis role. And Eddie Lewis is so important the last 5 or 6 years of Arena's 8-year tenure with the U.S. I mean, such a critical player that people forget about. That quick player that can be either a pure winger or can cut inside, had a killer left foot, and could deliver nice crosses into the area and beat anybody for pace, really. So I think you're going to see probably more genuine wide play and wing play under Arena than you did under Klinsmann, but again, he's going to be as limited as Klinsmann was in some respects by the personnel, because this is club football. You don't get transfer windows. We're talking about Bob Bradley in the transfer window. Arena's just got to do a better job with the personnel, and I would argue it's pretty difficult to do worse than Klinsmann did with the personnel he had at his disposal. That having been said, there are people who argue to the contrary of what I say, and perhaps they'll be proven right if Arena mismanages this pool. But I think Bruce is pragmatic enough, and he's learned enough since he got fired from the job 10 years ago and changed some of his style, that qualification for the World Cup really still shouldn't be very difficult in spite of these two results. But the change has to be made. This is the latest possible point of change to be made. If you went through another cycle of qualifiers with Klinsmann and dropped points, let's say, in Panama, then it might have been very difficult to bring in a Bruce Arena and salvage him.
Yeah, and Panama's playing well.
Yeah, Panama's playing very well.
I think that this is an interesting little kernel that kind of connects the Bradley at Swansea discussion and then just more traditional American fan discussion, which is to say there's criticism. The biggest defense of Klinsmann was always a defense of him as technical director, right? It was always,
Well,
look at the players that he's brought in. Look at the recruiting that he does. Almost like he was the head coach of a college football team. And, you know, I think as a CEO in that respect, Jurgen is actually quite bright. Jurgen's a real big picture guy. So he kind of sees things, you know, he can see broad views. He's not so good at details. And to manage a national team effectively, I think you have to be great at details, or you have to have someone on your staff that is, which is why Yogi Löw and him worked. But it's also interesting that people that defended Klinsmann, you would call them on that, right? You'd say, well, you're just defending him as technical director. And then they'd say, well, it's not his fault as manager that the players don't execute, which is, of course, internally inconsistent with what many of those same people say about Bob Bradley. Well, it's Bradley's fault that Swansea had such horrible results. It's like, okay. So it's fair to criticize the American manager's tactical setups for why Swansea fails, but it's not fair to criticize Jurgen Klinsmann and his tactical setups for why America fails. Because I'm, you know, and I think the truth is probably somewhere in between, but it is interesting to me that kind of discussion exists, that those sorts of defenses of Jurgen Klinsmann existed, and they don't seem to always apply to American managers, or am I being too patriotic maybe?
No, I think you're right. One of the things that's bothered me is that the people who defended Klinsmann seem to be doing it for ideological, rhetorical reasons. They were people who are unhappy with the system in the U.S. They are unhappy with Major League Soccer. They have a certain affection by having a foreign manager, although I would argue methods and tactics are fairly Americanized. I mean, I don't think he could get a job in Europe and not get counted out of that job rather quickly, as quickly as Bradley was. So I think there were defenses of Klinsmann that were always conducted around rhetoric, ideology, and stylistic consideration that you could interpret as defenses of him as technical director, but I think the people making the arguments weren't even thinking that way. They were just angry at the system. And part of my thinking about Klinsmann's entire tenure was that he was able to ratchet up this kind of malcontent faction that would defend him regardless of results, regardless of the metrics that he himself had set when he took the job. That said, judge me based on A, B, and C. Well, we judged you based on A, B, and C. We failed on all three, all four, all five, however many bullet points he threw out there. So I think he was very smart and manipulative in how he played this group of people. And they're the same people who seem to be cheering actively against Bob Bradley's success at Swansea. So I'm not taking sides in this because I think they have some very valid points. I just think that the whole well has been poisoned, but Klinsmann partly did that with his rhetoric. And some of his rhetoric is spot on, which is why I still think he might make a good technical director for the U.S., but since he was such a poor manager, that will never happen in the future.
Yeah, I don't think it's ego necessarily. And he was very classy after being dismissed. But I don't think necessarily that doesn't mean that the man lacks an ego. I think, you know, I don't think he was ever going to do the job without having the other one. And maybe we'll never know if that was discussed. Let's talk about a different manager. Let's talk about Jill Ellis to kind of close. Because I thought this was an interesting year in the sense that we're talking about a women's national team that didn't lose. And didn't win a medal, which is really unusual. So obviously they fail to make some history and then win an Olympics immediately after winning a World Cup. The disappointing loss in penalties to Sweden, the combustible situation with Solo after, maybe no one realized or noticed outside of, you know, kind of hardcore inner women's national team circles, the hardcore women's fans, I'm certain noticed. And we're going to get John O'Halloran on this show in a couple weeks and some other people to talk about the team. But Jill Ellis made a lot of tactical innovations and kind of stuck with them in the end of the year friendlies. They gave me a positive kind of sense of direction about where this team is headed. We'll get into the CBA question in a second, but what are some of your thoughts on, you know, what Ellis's sort of imprint on the team was? You think she's finally recognizing now that she can't just rely on Carly Lloyd to kind of roam around and poach goals? I mean, it seems like Tobin Heath has become a focal point, and that the U.S. is instead of relying on athletes, they're really trying to create and impose a style of play on opponents. And the results, at least in the friendlies, were pretty positive.
Right. I hate to bring this back up, but I have to say it to say my piece. Tom Sermani was trying to do it. He understood that the women's game had changed and the United States could not rely on athleticism exclusively any longer. And somehow we got away with it in the 2015 World Cup, although there were bumps on the road, serious bumps on the road. I think the program would be further along if Sermani had been retained as manager. But that was done 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago. Done. And Jill Ellis certainly was in the teeth with winning the World Cup. But I'm very encouraged, as you mentioned, about the changes we saw in the friendlies that came after the and the kind of harmony we saw among the squad, and in embracing, I think, a more aggressive approach and an approach that relied on some technical ability, some tactical now, rather than just outpacing teams and playing the ball Abby's ability to hold the ball off and turn and score, or Carly Lloyd's ability to just score these belters from distance that kind of just whitewashed the fact that we've been outplayed in whichever game it was we're talking about. I think she's getting it. She's got 2.5 years really to get it right. From this point. I think maybe people like me misjudged her because she took over for Sermani and it was pretty far along in the cycle. And she just has to go back to basics, get the kind of results that we're seeing Arena's going to have to get down. The men's team. She was able to get those results, albeit in a difficult fashion. And then right away after that, you're trying to repeat that with another Olympic gold medal. You fail at that. But now is your opportunity to change the playing style, bed in new players, really kind of build around someone like a Morgan Brian, young players like that, Tobin Heath. And
I think
I'm pretty upbeat about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think because she got outcoached by Pia, and because of the suspension to Holiday at the World Cup, I think those kind of two events made it so that Ellis didn't really receive some of the credit I think she's due. I mean, she's still, regardless of suspension,
The suspension to Holiday force her to do something she wouldn't have done otherwise? That's
right.
I think the enduring question from the World Cup in 2015, that had Lauren not been suspended, we might have kept playing the way we were playing and been eliminated by Germany.
Right, and no one ever flips that around, right? Which is to say, who's to say she wasn't going to make that change? Like, it's not necessarily we don't know that. We don't know that she wasn't going to – they used Morgan Brian quite a bit in the build-up to that tournament. I mean, it was obvious that she was going to play a critical role. So we don't know the answer to that. And then, you know, Jill told me after Lauren's last match, which was in Orlando, that it was going to be difficult in the next 9 months to replace Lauren Holiday. And I think that the Pia having the perfect tactical plan for the U.S. without Lauren Holiday, Pia got a lot of credit for that, but Jill saw it coming. It wasn't like yes, Joe probably could have come up with a plan that was better and not reactive to what Sweden wanted to do. But at the same time, Jill knew that there was going to be an adjustment period to life without Lauren Holiday, who I think was one of the more underrated players in the history of the program. So, and they still didn't lose. They just lost. It's incredible what the bar is for when, you know, a manager gets credit. I mean, as you spoke to it with Tom Sermonti, he had an undefeated calendar year, went to one tournament, things went poorly because he tried something, and he was fired. The internal reasons for that, we'll never know. Everybody speculates. But, you know, I think Ellis deserves at a minimum a lot of credit for integrating some new faces in the late friendlies and trying a style that makes a lot of sense for the personnel that the U.S. has. Which leads to the final question that we wanted to talk about. Alex Morgan has announced that she's going to play at Lyon. How much of that is about the collective bargaining agreement? I'm sure the people in Orlando are very upset. I know some of them that are upset. We don't need to get into whether or not they're being myopic, but we do need to talk about, you know, we do need to talk about why she would make that choice. And I think it's pretty evident that the CBA discussions aren't going well.
Yeah, there are one or two friends of mine in Orlando that are that have a more global view of this and have taken a mature position on it. There are others who have not. I have a lot of friends in Orlando. I think everybody who's listening knows and spent a lot of time.
That kind of simplifies everything for me.
I think this has a lot to do with the CBA. I think it also has to do with the recognition that the top European clubs at this point are paying better money in many cases than the U.S. Soccer Federation is paying in NWSL, and that there's a higher level of play in the Champions League specifically, maybe not into the domestic league, but Lyon is going to be facing off on the Champions League with a number of top clubs from Germany, Chelsea and Manchester City from England, who have for people who just follow the men's game, they have very, very strong women's clubs also because they pay more money. I should point this out. Steph Houghton, who's the captain of England's national team, is a central defender for Manchester
right.
City. She makes more money, I believe, than any U.S. women's national team player does. She's close. But she doesn't have the pedigree. She obviously captained the team that finished third in the World Cup and has been very good in their domestic league. But I don't think Steph Houghton has the pedigree in the game that the likes of so many U.S. women's national team players.
He makes
do,
more money than Becky Stauber, right?
Who you and I agree might be the best. Yeah, yeah, at that position. So the point I guess I'm getting around to is that the top European clubs, partly fueled by their men's club, and that's the issue with Chelsea and Manchester City, I assume with Lyon also. I don't follow the French league as closely, but are able to pay top salaries to top women's players that the NWSL clubs simply won't. So I think there's got to be some understanding of that. But then that brings us right back to the CBA, doesn't it? That if England national team players, Jill Scott makes a lot of money for Manchester City as well, and Izzy Christensen and a bunch of other English players make good money there. They have one American, Daphne Corbeau, who was a star at Georgetown, whose sister's a star now for Georgetown. But it's an opportunity for American players, and the level of play, at least in the Champions League, is higher than NWSL currently. So I think she's going to learn new things in her game. I think her game, which some people complain is very one-dimensional, is going to improve. I think the other thing, and I don't want to get into a myopic criticism of Alex Morgan, but I guess I'm going to, from folks in Orlando and in Portland, is that she's so focused on the national team that she doesn't really put the same level of effort or work or concentration into the club team like Sinclair did in Portland or whoever does in Orlando. So there have been those critiques of her, which I don't necessarily share, by the way, but I'm just repeating them. And now I think she's going to be in a position where she's going to have to prove herself on the club level. She's going to have to work every day in training to be in the squad. She's going to be playing in training or training with players at her level. Whereas in Orlando, she's the star. In Portland, she had Christy Sinclair, but that's one other major star, right? And there were a couple of big players there, but not 11 big players like there are at Lyon. So I think it's a positive move from a soccer standpoint. But I guess we can't escape the CBA reality, right? And it is what it is. I think all things being equal, she doesn't pull the trigger at this point in time to go, if not for that CBA situation.
And we're going to go – normally we will go 45 minutes so people know. I mean, I think first show, so we're not only ironing out kinks, but there was so much to discuss. You know, the CBA – look, the players are going to get paid. Even if it expires, there's a 60-day period where it kind of phases itself out. But, I mean, a lot is hanging in the balance. Next week we're going to talk about some of the off-season stuff that's happening in MLS. We'll get into the USL and the NASL and all that chaos a little bit. And we'll answer some of the tweet questions that we got next week as well. But I think – hanging over the show for the next few weeks is going to be this question of the CBA. I don't think they're close. They just dismissed Ron Nichols. The Players Association, you don't usually dismiss your union chief if you're close. You do it because you don't like the advice you're getting from him. I know this because I've negotiated settlements. the labor dispute is, I don't think they're close. I don't think that the parties are near one another. I think the women rightly believe that the wage discrimination complaint, which hasn't been ruled on yet, hasn't been decided yet. I think they rightly believe that's a bargaining chip they still have. I think Sunil Gulati's position is somewhat narrow that, hey, look at all the stuff we do for women's soccer. And I think he really believes that sincerely. And I think there's obviously some truth to that, that the U.S. does do a lot for women's soccer. It does not mean, and I think your examples about what players are paid in Europe, does not mean that they get compensation right? You can agree on both of these things. You can agree with Gulati a little bit and also agree with the players that, hey, we need to be compensated better. And that – in the way that things are structured, where U.S. soccer props up the NWSL, you have to deal with the bread-winning USWNT and then hope that down to, and I hate the term, to the NWSL, right? Like, it's how do you prop up NWSL salaries? Well, you make sure, first of all, that the people that have an incentive to play there are compensated properly with the national team. I don't think there's any other way around that. What are your kind of final thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm in very much kind of the same place as you. I think that the U.S. Soccer Federation has done more to promote this game and women's soccer and women in soccer than any national federation outside of maybe the Scandinavian federations through the years, outside of Sweden and Norway, right? Certainly the top three with those two. That having been said, this is now an era where the federations, the big massive global football powerhouse federations of France, Germany, and England have now, in the last 10 years, decided to take women's soccer extremely seriously, and they're pouring resources into it. They are elevating the level. They're using the infrastructure they have at existing clubs, at existing top flight men's clubs. Like the Lyons, like the Eintracht Frankfurt, like the Manchester Cities and Chelseas and Arsenals, to really raise the bar in this sport in terms of pay and in terms of visibility. I can tell you this as someone who follows and covers Manchester City, that they pump out women's Manchester City ladies, women's team. It's called the women's team now. It used to be called the ladies team. The women's team content. Constantly, they're pushing it. They're forcing it on men's fans. They're forcing it on those who don't follow women's soccer, and that's a mandate from the FA. And obviously, we have a couple clubs here attached to men's clubs: Portland, Houston, and Orlando. In our top flight, we have some other clubs, Seattle, DC United women in lower divisions, but who play in other venues or other arenas than NWSL. But I think that whole aspect of marrying the women's game to the success and infrastructure of the men's game in Western Europe has raised the bar to where pay is higher than it was. Okay. And I go back to that Steph Houghton or Jill Scott example. They're making more money than they would if they were U.S. women's national team players, and they're England national team players. And England is just coming of age in this sport, right? They have not, they don't have anywhere near the level of accomplishment that their counterparts, that Becky Sauerbrunn, Steph Houghton has nowhere near the level of accomplishments that a Becky Sauerbrunn or Allie Krieger or defender for the United States has. Something that the U.S. Soccer Federation has to recognize. Now, we don't have the strong men's professional league that can maybe absorb the costs. Because let's face it, Manchester City, Chelsea, Arsenal, they're all losing lots of money on their women's teams. But they've been told that there's this mandate, and it's now becoming just, I don't want to call it a vanity project, but it's a thing where the owners of those clubs have to just accept they're going to lose a lot of money. But that's part of the culture now. We don't have that ability with our men's teams to attach it to our women's teams. So it has to come from the federation level, because we've constantly made a push out of the U.S. women's national team being above the clubs, and that's probably right. That's a driver of interest and of marketing and of success and TV and all those things. So I think Sunil Gulati and the U.S. Soccer Federation have to acknowledge this reality and look at what's happening in Western Europe and realize, you know what? We're probably going to have to pony up and make it incentivize this so that not just this generation that's fighting the fight, but the next generation doesn't lose interest in women's soccer and we don't fall behind the Western European countries, because Germany and France are extremely close to us already in terms of quality. I think we all know that. We got by Germany in the World Cup. We got by France in the Oligarch Cup earlier that year, although they had beaten us badly previous to that whenever we played them. So, you know what? Maybe we didn't even play them in that Oligarch Cup. I can't remember if we played them or if we just avoided them on route to winning. I'd have to look that up.
Well, the point remains. I mean, England had a tactical blueprint that Sweden essentially used. England played us terrific in Tampa in the She Believes Cup. And Pia pretty much used the same formula to force the game into penalties. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of work to be done on that front. But it priority is making sure that they're there to play. Because if they don't get a collective bargaining agreement, what that portends for the NWSL and beyond down the road in 2017 is rather frightening. Kardik, this was fun, and I'm looking forward to this as we enter a new year. Happy New Year to you and your family. Happy New Year to everybody that's listening. And thanks for bearing with us today on episode one of the Yanks Are Coming Soccer Show.
Yeah, same to everybody out there. Happy New Year to everybody, and this is going to be fun, and we look forward to bringing this to you in 2017. And for better or for worse, Neil, I think we're going to be talking a lot about the CBA and what women's national team players do as we enter the new year.
Yeah, no, I think there's no question about that. All right, man, I appreciate you again, and we'll talk next week.
Yep.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.